also honorary president of Penal Reform International, and she, for 20 years, she was Director General, Secretary General of NACRO, the National Association for the Care and Resettlement of Offenders. And since 1999, she has been a crossbench peer and a member of the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights from 2004 to 2007. She's also a member of the Advisory Council of the International Legal Center and the Advisory Council of the Legal Policy Research Center in Almaty. In addition to all this, she is a prolific writer, and she has written many, many books on prisons, Bricks of Shame, Britain's Prisons, and her latest book, which is partly something she's going to tell us about today, is called Creating Criminals, People and Prisons in a Market Society. Barnston.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. I hope you appreciated the furniture removal and general reorganization of your place here, but I'm trying to be able to see everyone at once. I'm not quite making it. I'm very, very happy to be here. This is a very famous and prestigious law school, and it's a privilege to have been invited, and I'm very grateful that so many of you have come to listen to me talking about a subject that inhabits a dark corner of our society and that many people would be happy not to know much about. There's a lot to be said about prisons. I've spent much of my life reading, writing, and thinking about them, and occasionally being in them in all regions of the world. And these have been experiences which show humanity at its worst and sometimes at its best. So I shall try, in the time we have today, to give you an inkling about that experience and to leave you with a question that I think needs answering. The question is, what are prisons for? I saw on your website this statement: the contextual approach has been developed at Warwick for over 25 years. Our aim is to avoid treating law as if it can be separated from other aspects of society. Since it says this on your website about the intellectual environment here, you'll know that the question, what is prison for, is not to be answered so easily with the lawyer's reply, which says, what a simple question. We know what prison is for. It's in all the books. Prison is for the punishment of crime, for retribution, maybe reformation, and the protection of the public. Well, we're going to try and go a bit deeper than that today. And I think I'm going to begin with a story which you might appreciate, something contextual. I want to read you a quote from a letter. The letter says this: I can't last much longer, and I will end up trying to kill myself. This time, I will probably succeed. At least I will be with Nana and Grandad. And that means he will be in heaven. If I could have the chance to be at home with my family, I will never get into trouble again in my life. Anyway, I've got to go now because I'm too upset to write. This is an extract from the last letter that Adam Rickwood wrote to his mother. He was 14. He was 5'1" tall. He had severe emotional problems. He'd been in hospital 7 times for harming himself. He got into trouble. Eventually, he appeared in court, charged with wounding with intent. He was sent to a children's home to wait for the legal proceedings to take place. It went fine. He settled down very well. His mother bought him a rabbit, which he looked after. Suddenly he was sent away 150 miles from home to a place called a secure training centre. A secure training centre is a prison-like place for teenagers as young as 12, run by a private security company. There are four of them, and they're run not by companies that specialise in childcare, but companies, all-purpose companies. They transport cash, they read electricity meters, they also run private prisons for adults. Now, on the night of the 9th of August 2004, there was a little bit of bother at this secure training centre. Adam refused to go to his room when they told him to. Then, according to the reports, a first response team was called in. Four prison staff overpowered Adam and carried him face down to his room. Adam tried to bite one of them. So the man responded with a technique known as, and I quote, a nose distraction. And I just want to alert you to something here. Watch the words. In the prison world, if something is very distasteful, we call it something that's not quite so horrible sounding so that no one will understand. A nose distraction is putting pressure, upward pressure, on the nose to cause pain so that the person feels enough pain to stop doing whatever they're doing. So they hit Adam on the nose, his nose bled. He then flooded his room as a sort of protest, and sometime between 11:45 and midnight, he hanged himself with his shoelaces from a curtain rail. There was an inquest. The man who'd hit him on the nose told the inquest, "There's no way I would hurt a child in our care. That's why I warned him twice. The manual says we're supposed to warn them once, but I did it twice." Little did anyone know, when Adam was sent from the home with the rabbit, he had to leave the rabbit behind, to the privately run children's prison, that this action would lead to so much, that his name would become so well known to lawyers, to judges, to parliamentarians, to policymakers. Little did his mother, who was called Carol Pounder, know, as Adam reached his 14th birthday, that in that year she would lose her son and she would move into a world where she had to speak in public, appear on television, come to the Houses of Parliament, and she'd have her name on a judgment of the High Court of England. How did all that happen to Carol Pounder? Well, this is the course of events. Adam had the distinction of being, as a judge put it, the mournful distinction of being the youngest person ever to die in custody in the United Kingdom. After his death, there was an inquest. At the inquest, it emerged that the use of force to restrain children, with the addition of inflicting pain, was being used to get them to obey orders. It appeared that this was against the rules laid down by the government. According to the rules, force should only have been used to prevent harm or serious damage. How did the coroner at the inquest deal with that? He decided to deal with it by saying, "This is an anomaly that needs to be cleared up. It seems they've been using force in this way over several years, and it seems this is in contravention of the rules." Once the coroner had said that and written to the government about it, the government had two choices. One, they could tell the secure training centres, the children's prisons, to keep the rules. They could say, "Stop using force and stop inflicting pain to get obedience to your instructions." After all, using violence and inflicting pain on people under 18 is quite controversial, and rather against the spirit of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and has been the subject of very heated debates in Parliament. So that's one thing they could have done. Or, of course, they could change the rules to make it lawful. And I'm not giving any of you a prize if you can guess which they did, because it's too easy. They changed the rules, of course they did. In July 2007, after a heated debate in the House of Lords, they brought in a new statutory instrument to make it lawful for the companies that ran the four private juvenile prisons to use force and inflict pain to maintain good order and discipline. The rule changed caused a bit of an uproar. A case was brought before the Queen's Bench Division that the new rules were unlawful. The court found that what had happened was unsatisfactory in many ways, but allowed the rules to stand. There was an appeal, and eventually the Court of Appeal reversed that judgment. It quashed the rules and said the way they were introduced was unreasonable and they were unlawful because what they permitted was in breach of the European Convention on Human Rights, Article 3, forbidding inhuman and degrading treatment, and Article 8, respect for family life. It therefore became clear that the government was now without any cover. The use of force against the young people to get them to obey orders, which was not allowed by the contracts with the private companies, nor in the rules, was unlawful. The government didn't like that decision, so they tried to appeal to the House of Lords. The request was refused. At last, the road was clear for a judicial review of the decision of the Durham coroner to refuse to allow the jury at Adam's inquest to consider a verdict of unlawful killing. Those representing the family tried very hard to get the coroner to allow the jury to consider the fact that the use of force was clearly unlawful. The coroner wouldn't allow it. The case was decided on the 22nd of January, just 2 weeks ago. The judge, Mr. Justice Blake, ruled that the inquest must be reheard. He said, if a properly directed jury found that there was a contribution to the death caused by Adam's unlawful treatment, that adds urgency and poignancy to the lessons that remain to be learned from the death. Now, you may be wondering, why has she told us that long story? And there are several reasons. First of all, what I want to do is to make it clear that prisons are full of people, real people of all ages, bad, some of them, sad, maybe, guilty, sometimes not guilty. But all people with names, personalities, mothers, fathers, a wide range of circumstances. And to just describe them as criminals, offenders, or by what they've been convicted of, murderers or arsonists, for example, does not do justice to what we find, the complexity of what we find in the prisons of the world. And that thought, each incarcerated person is an individual, is the basis of Article 10 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which defines how the whole world is expected to treat its detained people. All persons deprived of their liberty shall be treated with humanity and with respect for the inherent dignity of the human person. Secondly, I told you the story about Adam Rickwood so that it reminds you that there's a lot of law in prisons. Prisons are places where liberty is taken away and people are completely at the mercy of others for everything, their food, their accommodation, which prison they end up in, near home or 300 miles from home. At the end of the day, they can be dependent on others for life itself. So there's a lot of law to prevent abuses, international human rights law and domestic law, and many opportunities for campaigning lawyers who want to see a more just world to fight for it. And I assume many of you who are law students come into that category. You came into the law to see a more just world, and you will be fighting for better treatment of people like Adam. Another reason why I told you that story, I thought it would be worth at least noting the impact of the arrival of private sector companies into imprisonment. And the interesting situation, when a private sector provider ignores what's in the contract and decides to reinterpret the law so that he can run his institution with the number of staff he has. Because under the costings he put in to get the contract, the staffing levels were low. The judges in both the appeal court and the High Court were most unimpressed with the idea that not having enough staff was a very good reason to break the law. This was the case put by the private sector company. And the judgment of the, both these judgments are worth reading for that alone. So I wanted you to get a bit of an idea of the implications of contracting out prisons to private companies. Finally, I wanted to tell you about Adam, to give you an idea of how we're using the justice system. The justice system you can see as a great big broom. And once the criminal justice system is allowed to have its way, lots of new laws, lots of more possibilities for punishment. Once it is allowed to operate so widely, it sweeps up many people like Adam and his mother. One of my little achievements in the House of Lords last year, and achievements in the House of Lords are usually very little, was to winkle out of the government how many new imprisonable offences have been created since 1997. I got an answer. Since 1997, they have created 1,036 new imprisonable offences, not just criminal, imprisonable offences in primary legislation, and an additional 446 in regulations. And if you want a reference for that, you'll find it in Written Answers, House of Lords. So I wanted you to have before you an impression of the human beings involved, the policies in place, and the legal framework, before going on to some facts and figures. What are the prisons of the world like? I will summarize and generalize. They are overfull. 110 out of the world's 218 prison systems for which we have information are overcrowded. I have been in rooms with 50 bunk beds, three high, holding more than 150 prisoners. And I tell you, when they open the door of a room like that, you have to stand back so as not to be knocked out by the smell that hits you. But normally, that door is shut and people are living in there. In some places, prisoners sleep standing up, tied to window bars, and people have been known to suffocate because there just wasn't enough air. Prisons can be and often are very violent. In the United States, they have what I think is an astonishing law called the Prison Rape Elimination Act. At least they're honest about it. There's a lot of prison rape to try and eliminate. George Bush actually passed that act, and one can only say, as with prisoners, there is the potential for the good, for good in everybody. Talking about violence, I visited the federal prison in Brasilia, We sat in the office of the governor, who was a nice young man, about the age of some of you young people here. Nice young man in a T-shirt. We sat there for a long time. And I began to think they were going to do what sometimes happens. Oh, I'm afraid we can't let this visit go ahead. We've had a call. It's not a good day for a visit. But actually, no. We were sitting there until there appeared 8 huge National Guardsmen armed to the teeth with machine guns and grenades. And only then could the governor go into his prison and we could go in too. There are murders in the prisons of Latin America on average every day. Prisons are places where disease is concentrated because of the nature of the people in them, and where disease spreads because of the nature of the living conditions. TB and HIV are widespread. The fact that some drugs are illegal adds hugely to the health hazards in prisons. It's estimated that between 1/5 and 1/4 of the world's prison population is there because of activities connected with the illegality of some drugs. The effect on prison life has been to increase the dangers and the violence. Drug use increases the spread of disease because they share needles. The authorities battle to stop the illegal drugs coming in. They take measures that greatly worsen prisoners' treatment. In some places, prisoners, men and women, have to urinate in front of prison staff to make sure that the samples they use to test for drugs are not falsified. It means that grills are put up between prisoners and family members who visit, so they can't touch or hold their children. There's plenty of ill treatment. And then there are the women in prison. About 1 in 20 of all prisoners are women. They're usually an afterthought in policy terms, housed in buildings designed for men and dealt with by policies devised for men. The women are in prison are, and I generalise only a little, either convicted of very serious crimes, like murdering a husband. And I'll just tell you one little story. I was in a prison in Guatemala with a lot of women, and this grandmotherly lady with very few teeth was being chatted to. And someone said, "What did you do to get in here?" And she went into a great cackle and said, "Ha, I murdered my husband." They're the same women the world over. Last year, I visited a prison in Japan. This prison was a very long way from the main centres of population. So we went there, we went on a bullet train, first of all, and as you know, they go very fast. Then we went onto another train, which went quite slowly. Then we went on another train with just one carriage that went very, very slowly. And then we took a taxi from the station for several miles. The prison was at the end of Yamaguchi Province, a place where economic development was needed. And if I can quote from the briefing we were given, it is an economic enterprise area. They wanted real business, but they got a prison. At least, though, the local government gets the income tax, the tax income, and can count the prisoners as residents for the census, which boosts their grants from central government. The prison, the day we went, was holding 290 women and 261 men. For the women, their main crime was, and I quote here, drug addiction. We met the women. They looked exactly the same, battered, unconfident, depressed women that you can see any day in Holloway Prison in North London. But they had fewer visitors at the far end of Yamaguchi Province. Then there are the minorities. Go to a prison of any country in the world, see who's overrepresented, and you'll know who it is they discriminate against. I was in New Zealand last year, too. Of the prisoners in New Zealand, over half, 51%, are Maori. They make up 14% of New Zealanders. I was in Perth, Western Australia. Aboriginal people in Western Australia are 3%. They make up 40% of the prison population. An Aboriginal elder who opened this conference in Western Australia gave a very nice, very welcoming speech to everyone. But he ended up by saying this: when Western Australia gets an economic boom, which it was just having, what do the Aboriginal people get? We get a nice new prison. And in the United States, at the end of 2007, the black male imprisonment rate was 3,138 for every 100,000 US residents. And the white male imprisonment rate was 481. So I think that's a ratio of 7 to 1. The imprisonment rate for black women was 150, and the white female imprisonment rate was 50, a ratio of 3 to 1. And prisoners everywhere are overwhelmingly poor, undereducated, unemployed, and in ill health. More than half of American prisoners have mental health problems. There are 9.8 million prisoners in the world, or 10.7 million if you count the 850,000 in administrative detention in China, but I'm not going to count them for the moment. That's an increase of 1 million since 2002, but the increase is not happening everywhere. 7 out of 10 countries have had an increase. 3 out of 10 have stayed the same or reduced. 2.3 million of all the prisoners in the world are in the United States. The United States has 5% of the world's population and 24% of the world's prisoners. We usually measure imprisonment rates per 100,000 of the population. The highest imprisoner in the world is the United States, with 756 out of every 100,000. Then there's a big gap. There's a gap of over 100 till we get to Russia with 629, and then Rwanda with 604. The lowest, apart from some small islands, is Burkina Faso with 23. And you might wonder where this information comes from. It's all available on a website called www.prisonstudies.org, where you will find information on all the prison systems of the world. There are big differences between seemingly similar countries. The US, 756. Next door, Canada, 116. That's a big difference. The US is more than six times Canada. Spain, 160. Portugal, a little bit down there, 103. England and Wales, 152. Germany, 89. What explains these differences? Well, you might think the answers are obvious. There's more crime in some countries than others, and the ones with more crime have more people in prison. I'm sorry, but there's not much evidence to support that hypothesis. We'll try this one. There's less crime in some countries than in others because more of the criminals are in prison. There isn't much evidence for that hypothesis either. In fact, it's not possible to link crime rates to imprisonment rates in any way that will explain the differences I've just given you. There's a man called Tapio Lapisepala at the National Research Institute of Legal Policy in Finland. He's the man who studied prison population levels over many years, and his view is quite helpful in giving us an answer to the question we started with: what is prison for? He says, and he has many, many charts to prove it, countries with high income inequality have higher prison populations than more equal countries. Countries with low trust in their legal system and criminal justice arrangements have higher prison populations than countries where the system has credibility. The more social trust there is in a country, then the lower the use of prison. And finally, countries that spend more money on welfare spend less money locking their people up. So we know four things about having a lower prison population. It goes with low income inequality, trust in the legal system, trust in each other, and using public money more for welfare than for punishment. And I'll add another. Countries with high prison populations have a tendency to create criminals. What can that mean? Well, to understand that, we have to understand something about crime. There's a very distinguished Norwegian criminologist called Niels Christie. He said once, "Since crime does not exist as a stable entity, the crime concept is well suited to all sorts of control purposes. It's like a sponge. The term can absorb a lot of acts and people when external circumstances make that useful." This understanding opens up for new questions. It paves the way for a discussion of what is a suitable amount of crime. So what is a suitable amount of crime? Every hour of every day, every minute of every day, events occur that could be described as crimes. People hit each other. People threaten violence to each other. Men lean out of their car windows and threaten to kill or maim other drivers. Not women, men. Property is taken unlawfully. Workers defraud their bosses. Citizens defraud the government. Taxpayers cheat the tax system. Sexual activity takes place involving those below the legal age for such activity. Many human interactions can be defined as criminal acts if someone wants to do so. All day, such actions take place. All of them could be classified somewhere as a crime. And in this country, we have become world leaders at looking at everyday human behavior and searching out aspects of it that can be turned into crimes. Jonathan Simon, who is professor of law at Berkeley, California, calls it governing through crime. He's written extensively about this process in the United States. I'll tell you another story about another human being. Patricia Amos. I don't know her, but I've read a lot about her. She's a mother with three daughters. She's a lady who's had a lot of problems. She had a kidney removed. She became addicted to painkillers. She started taking heroin. But after a while, she managed to get off heroin by undertaking treatment. Her drug problem was over. But her situation got worse and her family life fell apart. Her mother had been looking after them all. One day the girls came home from school and found the grandmother lying on the floor. She died 24 hours later. After that, Jackie, one of the three girls, became very unhappy and wouldn't go to school. In 2001, not sending your children to school became a crime that carried the punishment of prison. So in 2002, Patricia Amos got 60 days in prison for failing to send her daughter to school. Figures were published late last year which show that between 2003 and 2006, 71 parents, mostly mothers, were imprisoned. Yet last year, in spite of all this, truancy figures were at their highest since 1997. So how do we go about this process of creating criminals? We do it by putting on crime spectacles when looking at certain people. There's a very disturbed child. Adam Rickwood was a disturbed child. But the authorities put on the crime spectacles and they saw a dangerous teenager who is alleged to have attacked another boy. So they saw crime. And they didn't see adolescent mental health unit as the answer, they saw prison. The system chose that set of definitions and we got a tragic outcome. With Patricia Amos, the authorities saw an act that did not fit with the way they wanted to make the world. They saw it as an attack by her on their social policies. School is good, children must go there. How do we get people to make sure their children go there? All of us could have thought of some ways of dealing with Mrs. Amos's problem. Why did Jackie not go to school? Do you think she was frightened that if she left her mother, she'd go back on the heroin? Do you think when she got there, She found it a hostile and frightening place. We don't know, but nobody found out. It became a crime for Jackie not to go to school. Like having a firework in a public place if you're under 18, that's a crime for which you can go to prison. Or breaking the requirements of an antisocial behaviour order. This is something I read last month. Jonathan Holmes was yesterday jailed for 8.5 months by a district judge sitting at Wisbeach Courthouse. The judge activated an 8-month suspended sentence and added another 2 weeks for the antisocial behaviour order breaches. Holmes, a persistent shoplifter, was banned from several areas of the town under the order and was spotted back in town by members of the public. The police inspector in Wisbeach said, "This is a very strong message to people who are subject to an ASBO." Holmes had not committed any other offence apart from breaching his ASBO. He was seen twice in an area that he's not allowed to be in. On one occasion, he was seen in the horse fair, and on another, he was seen looking through the window of Boots. On both occasions, it was the community that informed us of the breach. Whereas before, we would have had to wait for a theft offence or something similar to have occurred, now the community can act before a crime occurs. I would have thought that that view of the law might make the lawyers in this room just a little nervous. Jonathan Simon from California sums it up. Social problems ranging from welfare dependency to educational inequality have been reconceptualized as crimes, with an attendant focus on assigning fault and imposing consequences. The result of this process is not to make communities safer, but the opposite. And Jonathan Simon says the outcome is to erode social trust, and with it, the very scaffolding of a free society. So what is prison for? Last week, a man standing at a bus stop with his 3-year-old daughter on the way to visit his wife and newborn baby in hospital was stabbed. Prison is for the person that stabbed him. We can, I think, all agree on that. Prison is for people who traffic women and children. Prison is for organized crime syndicates that terrorize and intimidate. We can agree on that. But if prison is for people who commit such appalling acts, can it also be for Adam Rickwood, Patricia Amos, and Jonathan Holmes? If prison is to show that an act is heinous and puts the perpetrator beyond being in society, and prison is to protect society from people who would stab others at bus stops, what's it doing holding the sick mothers, the children with behavioural problems, the persistent shoplifters? What is prison for now in countries like this one, where the number of people in prison has increased by 30% in the last 10 years, and where the government is undertaking a program of building another 20,000 places? Each prison place costs about £100,000 to build. What is prison for? It could be said that prison is for the unwanted of the current economic model. How do we know that they're unwanted? We know because of what we are doing. We know because if we wanted them, we would do something else. We would look at their problems and their situation and we would say, you need a bit of sorting out. You need help to be a functioning member of society. And because you are wanted as a citizen, as a taxpayer, as a contributor, here is help. Here's healthcare, here's drug treatment, here's education, here's social support. And then these unwanted people, once the crimes have been created to catch them, become the raw material of economic development in depressed areas like Yamaguchi in Japan. And if the government has its way, in Warrington, in the north of England, where the local community wants a business park, and where the government is trying to persuade them to agree to a plan for a Titan prison, a giant prison, holding 2,500 prisoners, trying to persuade them that that's not a bad substitute for a business park. So what is the future, do we think, for this way of dealing with the unwanted people? Well, this event is taking place at an interesting time for the world, as the ideology of unrestrained market forces sinks like a deflated hot air balloon onto the pavements of Wall Street. Maybe this is the time when money is short, when social solidarity will be what keeps us going. This may be the time that putting more and more poor people, more and more black people into prison on the false promise that this will make us safer goes out of fashion. If that's the way it's going to go, then I, for one, shall be celebrating. Because I know that as I become more and more, and I'm certainly getting there, more and more of a little old lady, I shall be a lot safer and find myself in a kinder world when we've stopped using punishment as a tool of social policy. Thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you for your patience in listening. To lose my voice.
Thank you very much, Vivian. This is a fantastic lesson of what law in context should be all about. I think it's a great reminder for us that how we should do it. I should also highlight that, you know, Baroness Stern is not only a brilliant speaker, but her work throughout her life has been of a sort of a committed defender of human rights and through her work at NACRO and Penal Reform International. We're going to have 20 minutes of questions.
Great.
So I will go to you. When I think he was Shadow Home Secretary, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. And the reflecting sadly how the second part of that mantra has not been addressed by government since. Indeed, as you very articulately suggest, that there's now an underclass which is possibly more alienated from society than arguably at any time.
Yes. How do we? We try a lot. And I think that it can only be about, as I hinted at the end, and it doesn't sound very serious, but it is going out of fashion. You reach the end of a certain road. And you can, a lot of ways in which, a lot of reasons why you might reach the end of that road, and it may be money is a reason. Because as long as we stay within the European Convention and have to keep prisoners within certain standards and provide healthcare and provide space and food and so on, it will continue to be expensive. And it's hard to tell. We live in very interesting times. But in times when there's less inequality, when people are more equal, even when people are poorer, support for harsh measures goes down. In the 1960s in the United States, support for the death penalty was under 50%. And in the last few years, it's been around 80 or so, and it's going down again. So it is a very difficult thing to predict. But one has to assume that it reaches a point, and I think this might be happening in the United States, it reaches a point where you can't go on doing it, I hope. And the costs of doing it and the political benefits to be gained by going on doing it don't any longer seem so great. And once other, we have many other things, we'll have many other things to worry about, won't we? Unemployment, people losing their homes, there'll be a lot of protests. Crime will no longer be the thing that people can use. Criminals will no longer be the scapegoat that politicians can necessarily put all their efforts into, because they've got bankers and they've got all sorts of other enemies. And it's possible that people will feel more tolerant when lots of people can't really manage on the money they've got. So how you make politicians do it, I don't know. It's interesting that there's a minority government in Scotland. Not many people know about this. It's not very well publicised. But they have this minority government in Scotland which has an avowed policy to reduce the number of people in prison considerably and to instead tackle the drink, the drugs, and the poverty that are underlying it. And this is not a policy that's making them unpopular, in spite of the Labour Party behaving in a most disgraceful fashion in trying to whip up hostility against that policy. So it does seem to me that if you do other things right as a politician, you don't need to use crime, and that once two political parties decide not to do it, it can stop tomorrow. And I'm just hoping that the current problems we face will mean they'll have to do that. But it is very, very difficult to stop them. And one does try, but it's not easy.
Mm.
Yes, 7,000 prisoners in India, in Pakistan. That's a big prison, isn't it? I don't know if you agree with me, but my experience of countries like yours is that prisons, it's very difficult for prisons to be afforded, actually. The colonial powers came along and said, this is what you do, and this is the sort of building you have, and you have a building, no doubt, that's a bit like Wormwood Scrubs in West London, and this is imprisonment, and you've got the rule book dating from the colonists in 1894, and then they all went home and left many countries with a completely dysfunctional system, because the cost of such a system is not affordable in the economic situation that you're in. And this is not easily solved, because I've seen over the last 20 years projects to try and solve it in Pakistan, in India, in Bangladesh, in Nepal, everywhere. There have been projects. And I'm sure you'll agree with me, the outcome is not great. Prison conditions are not that much better in any of the countries. And it may be that prison should be used in countries that are very poor, very, very sparingly. And then you would be able to have prison staff who were paid a living wage, who didn't have to rely on corruption and payments from prisoners in order to have enough money to feed their families. And they would be on a level with police and get that respect. But it's not been very easy to sell that message in any of the countries that I think we're talking about. But there's no doubt that a prison reform project should start with prison staff. And if you look at the handbook on human rights and prison management from the International Center for Prison Studies, which is also on our website, you will find that prison staff is the introductory chapter, because at the core of what a prison is like is the relationship between the prisoners and the staff, and the frontline staff, not the big bosses in the back office so much, but what happens on the front line. And therefore, investing in prison staff is the way that you reform prisons. And I entirely agree with that. But I don't know how you would persuade your government, or any other developing country would persuade their government, to put their money into prisons at a time like this. It is extremely difficult. And I have enormous sympathy for anybody who tries to do prison imprisonment properly in a very poor country, because it's a soul-destroying, difficult job.
But if society undertakes selective punishment, which is like not putting people who have broken the law into prison, what other options would it be? Wouldn't there be an outrage that the law is not punishing people who have actually broken the law as it should, selectively punishing people?
I'm very glad you made that point, because I don't want people to think that I'm advocating impunity, that I'm saying nothing should happen when bad things happen to people. I'm not saying that at all. I think it's deeply important that when bad things happen to people, there should be a response that recognizes what's happened to them. So I would personally think that we would do better if our victims' services were better, if there was more, if more resources were put into making sure that those who had suffered were recompensed, if poor people could get insurance so that they didn't lose all their possessions when there was a burglary, if there were insurance schemes for poor people in places where insurance companies won't go, and if there was more support for victims, then that would help people to feel that what had happened to them was recognised. Because at the moment, what do they get? What you are supposed to ask for, if you had a crime done to you, is punishment for the person. That's what's expected. The television camera will come in and the victim will say, I don't know how 5 years could be seen as enough for what happened. And that person is absolutely right, because you can't measure the suffering of somebody in the years of somebody else's punishment. It's not doable. So we need to try and think of it a different way. We need to be much more upfront in ensuring that people do not suffer so much from crime, don't get left and get nothing back. And then we have to look at those who've done it. And we have to, first of all, move out of it people who are doing these things because they're ill. One. This boy, Adam, was ill. I don't think there's any doubt. He was a really disturbed child. The poor old persistent shoplifter who looked in the window of Boots, I guess he was a homeless alcoholic, wandering about. Quite glad to go back to prison, actually, because there's nothing else for him much. Why we sent Mrs. Amos to prison for not sending her daughter to school is beyond me. I can see no logic in that at all. But for most people, it would be better, most people at the lower level that I'm talking about, it would be much better if we solved the problem and if the punishments that are alternatives to prison, of which there are many, they can do work for the benefit of the community. It's a very good thing. Make people who've committed crimes start thinking about other people, sympathising with other people, seeing their plight. It's very educational. It's a real way of people changing when they stop thinking about themselves all the time and see that there are other people and that they can help other people. Helping other people is very, very rehabilitative. And also dealing with the drink and the drugs. If people are addicted, there's nothing you can do. Punishment doesn't mean a thing because they're only thinking about that. So I agree with you absolutely, but I'm not going on to say that therefore the answer is punishment. I'm saying the answer is to support victims and to deal with the problems. And if you have public opinion surveys, people all say, I would much rather they dealt with the problem so he didn't do it again. Then I would feel that it was worth happening to me because it's not happening to anyone else. So I'm really suggesting that we should adopt a more practical approach. Try and solve the problem so it doesn't happen again. That would be much better for everybody. Is that helpful? Yep. Yep. Well, not as long as the government goes on talking, sort of supporting that with one side of its mouth and then talking up crime and toughness with the other. That actually is the strategy that they're trying to follow in Scotland, which is to make the community payback sentences that you're talking about much more visible. And they want them to start the next day. That's a very important decision, that they put the money in so that when somebody comes up in court and it's sort of said, oh, he got community sentence, he's walked free, nothing will happen for months, it starts the next day. And that is a way of making it clear. So that community ought to be able to see that the week of the trial and the conviction, somebody's out there cutting the grass in the park and making, you know, whatever they're doing. And in that sense, if a government, it's interesting to see what they're doing in Scotland, because you can see what a government tries to do when they seriously want to do it and when they don't play this political game of talking it up. And what they are trying to do is what you've suggested, which is to make the community sentences more visible, more credible. People are being involved in saying what the work should be. And there's a lot of support for that in communities where people have to live with people. And they know when they come back from prison, what are they like? They're just rushing to get the next load of drugs and to get drunk or whatever. And it's not effective. So I think it's very marketable if politicians have the sense to do that. It's an insoluble dilemma. Either take the baby in prison with you. Horrible. Bring your baby up in prison. Be separated from the baby. Horrible. The worst thing you can do, often. So it's not solvable. So maybe you go back a stage and maybe there's another solution. That we don't send mothers with young babies to prison at all. That's a solution. And it was always a feature of the law in Russia and countries that followed Russian law that mothers of young children had their sentences suspended until the children got to 14, by which time they normally didn't have to serve them, because it was felt that there was greater value to society in a child being brought up properly by the mother in a normal environment than in inflicting punishment. And this is now being talked about. It's also Scotland, isn't it? The Children's Commissioner in Scotland is trying to get an amendment to the law that the court has to hear a statement about the effect on dependent children of any sentence, and that the Convention on the Rights of the Child would require the court to think of the best interests of the child when confronted with the mother. So I would like to think that with the new equality duty, there'll be more interest in trying to stop the courts. You do see some really absurd cases where women who are 8 months pregnant and have got two at home are sent to prison. And the judge says, I can't take that into account. You've committed this offence. And you think, what could be going on in that stupid person's head? What does that stupid person think is the consequences? And how does that judge weigh up the social benefit of that decision? So I'm hoping that with more awareness of the fact that there has to be a duty of equality, it might help for the courts to be given more of a... would have to be more reflective on the social consequences of a sentencing decision. If mothers do go to prison with their babies, you do see around the world a vast variety of arrangements. And in the former Soviet countries, they all have well-staffed nurseries. Children stay till they're 8 or something. They are in the nursery. They see their mother in the evening. You also see places in Latin America where they all just live in a nice big family atmosphere. There's a very, very the sort of model women's prison in Western Australia where they live in houses with the children. And they go to a health centre and it all looks very much like a normal village. It's never the best thing for children. So we should try and stop doing it.
Calculated that as part of your crime researching it down on what the crime rate in prison was. I kind of did a back of the envelope calculation on how many cars I thought might occur in prison. But as far as I knew, no one had actually done the study of the crime rate in prison and integrated it with the crime rate figures to see whether the crime rate actually.
That's because you're looking at it with a logic that an academic would bring to it. But a politician would say, my dear chap, once they're in prison, we don't mind what's going on. The purpose of this is to get them put away. And if they're committing offences in prison, which of course they are all the time, my constituents are not going to suffer from that, are they? That's the point of it. No, well, he wasn't a politician. He was a Home Office civil servant.
He's a sportsman. I've never thought about the issue of crime in prison. I've never thought about the possibility that you could count that as a crime.
Well, that's right.
I've never heard anyone discuss the issue of crime.
Because there isn't a possibility. As soon as he put the idea up to ministers, they'd say, don't be so stupid. I mean, there's a bit of a political reality in there, isn't there? Well, I have to say that there's no evidence from anywhere in the world that prisons make people better people. And the usual effect of prison is to worsen everything about a person and for a person. That is the inexorable logic of an institution in which you put everybody who maybe shares some characteristics from the most deprived parts of society. You deprive them of the opportunity to be responsible, to be kind, to learn, to achieve anything. You humiliate them with the clothes you put them in, the fact that there's often no lavatories, the fact that they have to take their clothes off all the time in front of other people to be searched in most, sometimes in most disgusting ways. It is a real feat of human imagination to imagine that that could do any good to anyone. However, it's not nice to think, and this gentleman from Pakistan will understand this, if you run a prison or work in a prison, you want to do some good. Otherwise, what sort of a life is it? And so a good person in charge of a prison tries very hard to minimize those aspects which are so likely to make the person worse. Some Scandinavian prison systems are very realistic, and they put on their website, our prisons are this, our aim is to do the least damage. And that is a very realistic aim, because there's an enormous difference between a decent prison and a horrible prison. A prison can be a nightmare, a hellhole, a place where everyone is in fear, where the strong are terrorizing the weak, where people are sharing needles and getting sick, where the food is being taken away by the staff and sold in the market, and where people are dying who shouldn't die. And there's a whole spectrum, and this is not only poor and rich. This can happen in poor and in rich. And you can also have a prison which, in spite of everything that's difficult about a prison, they manage to preserve humanity, dignity, and give people some chance to develop their personality. And that's why prison staff, we come back to your question, are so important, because they could do the one or they could do the other. And the prison reform movement in the world tries to get the good prison that I've described. Even then, though, I have to say, even in a prison where people are not beaten and where it's not corrupt and where they don't have to use the toilet in front of everybody else and where they're not strip-searched in a horribly offensive way, a prison will not be a good place. A prison will always be a place which has within it the potential for humiliation, inhumanity, and for not allowing human beings to develop their potential. So don't ever think you can do the best good to anyone by sending them to prison. Only send them to prison when they are the sort of people who've stabbed someone at a bus stop or done something terrible, because it's not going to do society a lot of good to have many people in a place like that. Sorry, I know you wanted to believe in rehabilitation, but I can't tell you what's not true. It's
a couple more questions.
Yeah. Well, I am. People always ask me that because people want there to be one, right? And I'm sometimes tempted to make something up. But I have to tell you, no. There are prison systems which are not awful. Norway, Finland, Slovenia, Costa Rica. I'm running out of places. but the truth is, I can't give you the name of a country where you can go and see how it ought to be. No. I can tell you in Western Australia there's one very good women's prison. In Costa Rica they have a couple of very good prisons, but then they also have horrible ones. In Argentina there's a good prison, but the rest of the system is murderous. It's interesting that in the former Yugoslavia, before it all fell apart, they had some of the best. They had the best prison system probably in the world. For some reason, they managed to find the best bits of the Soviet system in terms of rehabilitation, getting people reintegrated, looking after each one to get them back into society. There was a time when Nicaragua had a very good prison population, but this never lasts. So I have to say, don't go looking for it, because it isn't there. Prisons are problematic, sad places, and the best thing is to have as few as possible, have small ones, and pay lots of money to the prison staff so that they look after them really well. That would mean that we were all safer, but nobody's going to do that.
Prisons would become more expensive, but when the government is heavily criminalizing more acts and there is less work, surely the crime rate would go up. So then for the government to put more people in prison, how can they solve the situation? Because if they suddenly go back on what they've done, surely they lose faith, face in front of the public, and probably then lose faith in the government. How can they rehabilitate people if people don't need to be consistent?
Well, this is one scenario, the one which is we might face. but I'm not convinced that we will. First of all, it's not absolutely clear that crime rises in economic times of economic trouble. Some crime will rise, but a lot of crime is related to, a lot of violent crime is related to the availability of alcohol. And if you can't afford to go out, not you personally, if people can't afford to go out drinking and get too drunk for words and then start stabbing each other, then they won't stab each other and the violent crime rate will be reduced. Maybe more violent acts will happen in the home, but we won't necessarily hear about them. So it doesn't follow that economic difficulties leads to a rise in the sort of crime that is very frightening to people. And, I was going to say the bankers have already stolen so much money, it's going to be really hard to commit crime at that scale ever again, but I won't say that. I'm not convinced that it's going to go that way, but I can see that you have a strong argument for saying it might. I'm just not sure that people will have the appetite to spend all that money when they can all feel that we're under economic pressure, and what's the point of sending all these people who are committing economic crimes like stealing to prison? What's the point of it? We're all in the same boat. I hope it will go that way, but you may be right.
I think I'm going to have to stop. It's a bit late now, and you've given us so much food for thought. Some very moving and interesting and some depressing things, but I think that the most important thing is that we thank you very much, and I hope that you come back very soon. I want to invite you all to have a drink with us.
Please.
And thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Was it? I was going to ask you a question.